The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN+.
Welcome to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. We are brought to you by Second City Works, which is the B2B arm of the world-famous Second City Theater. You can find us at secondcityworks.com. And this is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and your life. The term yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It's at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and making discoveries together. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
Today's podcast is going to be a little different. I'll be joined by two guests who both traffic in the world of ethics, albeit in very different ways. Erica Salmon Byrne is the Executive Vice President of Compliance and Governance Services for Ethisphere. She is also the Executive Director of the Business Ethics Leadership Alliance. Erica was previously a member of the New York Stock Exchange Governance Service Executive Team. She practiced law in Washington, D.C., and she has taught business ethics at the University of Denver. Jen Ellison teaches ethics at DePaul University and is a member of the Comedy Writing and Performance Faculty at Columbia College Chicago. She's been performing, writing, and directing in Chicago for nearly 20 years. As a resident director at the Second City, Jen has overseen two national touring companies, developed multiple shows for their outreach and diversity program, and directed Apes of Wrath for the ETC stage. Other directing credits include Collaboration, Trapdoor Theater, WNEP, and the Neo-Futurist, where she is an artistic associate. Erica and Jen, welcome to Getting to Yes And.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great to have you here. One of Second City's most successful ventures has been a thing called Real Biz Shorts, which are short, funny videos that provide context for e-learning modules. And when I tell people that one of our most successful categories is in the area of ethics and compliance, they're often surprised. That is until I remind them of what fertile ground ethics is for the world of comedy, like this clip from Second City in Chicago a decade ago.
I'm your senator. That's what I do. Whatever you need. Everything I do it for you. Okay, bye-bye. Sorry, fellas. Have a seat.
Oh, thank you.
What are we talking about today?
Well, Senator Williams, we both teach ethics.
I'm not familiar with it.
Ethics, Senator. Good and bad, right and wrong. We're professors at Georgetown University.
Sounds good. Let's learn about the ethics.
No, Senator. Ethics, not ethics. Although it's always good to learn about ethnicities.
Yeah, so that sort of tees it up. Erica, in March of this year, your company Ethisphere held a global ethics summit in New York, and I was pretty blown away by what I read in the report from that summit. For example, SailPoint reported that 1 in 5 employees polled would sell their work credentials to hackers, and 44% claimed they would do it for less than $1,000. That's amazing.
That is...
Yeah, it is amazing. You know, and it really goes to the point of all of this, Kelly, from my perspective. You know, I've always felt this way. Compliance and ethics risk is really about people risk, right? Yeah. At the end of the day, we've got this thing called the corporation, and setting aside, you know, whether it's a person for corporate contributions perspective, it can't actually do anything, right? Everything it does, all of its stuff, is done by individual people. And so the job of the compliance officer is to try and grab as much of the heart and mind share of a company's employees as it can to make sure that they're at least asking the right question and hopefully asking the question before they do the stupid thing.
Yeah, it's so funny how often this comes up in this podcast. We talk to all people in all different industries, and we look at a lot of core problems. We're like, oh yeah, stupid, it's about the people. Another stat notes that millennials have a high risk for noncompliance, and it said 48% had observed misconduct, and 26% say that they would turn a blind eye to that misconduct. I mean, is the millennial generation that different?
No, No, it really isn't. If you look at some of the other statistics, employees are 27% more likely to witness misconduct in a time of transition, layoffs, restructuring, that sort of thing. And they are more likely in those circumstances to keep their mouths shut because they don't want to rock the boat and risk their job. If you look at the statistics behind misconduct reporting, the number one and two reasons that people don't report misconduct is fear of retaliation. So something bad will happen if I speak up, or the company's not going to do anything about it anyway, so why bother? So, you know, I can sit on my hands because nothing would come of it anyway. You know, when you think about it, telling the company that something has gone wrong is an act of courage, whether it's a compliance failure or a quality failure. And so how do you as a management team contribute to an environment in which your people are comfortable telling you that they screwed up?
Yeah, that's really well said. Jen, you teach a lot of millennials, yes, right, at DePaul. Mm-hmm. And tell us a little bit about what you teach over there.
I teach ethics in video game development and cinema. So when I tell people that, usually it's met with a bunch of question marks shooting out of people's heads. And the idea is to first sort of lay the groundwork in terms of ethical language, because oftentimes, many of them, the only type of ethical teaching they've had might be from their religious tradition, yeah, something along those lines. And so the idea is to lay the framework for ethical language and then talk about it with regards to video games and cinema, also the internet and how do we read ethical norms through cultural material.
Right.
And so what's interesting to me is being able to, I've had a couple of like plagiarism issues,
right.
I think that's college students. I do think that there is something about them that is, they're often terrified they're going to get caught, or maybe they didn't study or they didn't spend enough time writing the paper or whatever that might be. But what I have discovered is that the kids actually want to do the right thing, but the fear they have of being yelled at or told that they're wrong or being shamed in some way. Shame is a huge factor in this. Mm-hmm. And so I think that when I'm able to lay the groundwork for, look, if you're having an issue, you need to come and talk to me. We can have a conversation about it versus sort of the steely-eyed gaze of, if you come talk to me, you're going to be,
right,
you're going to be trashed. I think that they respond to that very well. And so I think that that relates to the, you know, culture of compliance stuff, where if people feel like they are comfortable and able to and feel safe about talking about something they might have seen or might have even done themselves, mm-hmm, I think it makes it easier for them to experience that failure, learn from it, and start again.
Yeah. So, all right. So both Jen and Eric are familiar with the way Second City has traditionally played in this place, in the sphere, which is using comedy. And that's about getting across. Comedy's good because it's sticky. The messages, people pay attention. But I was kind of interested in how improvisation might play into this. Mm-hmm. And I am a novice, right, in this area. So I just, I Googled a lot. But I came up with, when I was Googling, some really interesting stuff. And I want to get both of your impressions from a quote by Samuel Wells. So Wells, who wrote a book called Improvisation, The Drama of Christian Ethics. He's a scholar and a vicar at St. Martin in the Fields in London. And Wells writes, quote, "When improvisers are trained to work in theater, they are schooled in a tradition so thoroughly that they learn to act from habit in ways appropriate to the circumstances. This is exactly the goal of theological ethics."
Hmm.
I was actually quite interested in the idea of what you need to do is create habit. A habit of compliance,
mm-hmm,
a habit of truth. Erica, what do you think?
No, I think that's exactly right. And one of the things that I find in my conversations with managers, now look, let's face it, for most companies, when someone is promoted to be a manager, they're promoted to be a manager not because they're a good manager. They're promoted to be a manager because they were good at the job they were doing,
yep,
right? And
yep,
it's time for them to move on to a new challenge inside the organization. They are very, very rarely prepared to be a leader, right, which is a different skill set.
Mm-hmm.
But they are often thrust into a role of leadership. And so what I think improv does so profoundly for that group in particular is create the habit of active listening.
Yes.
Because it's going to be the very rare employee that marches into your office, shuts the door, and says, "Hey, I just saw so-and-so handing a bag of cash to such-and-such," right? That's not the way these situations tend to come up. It's going to be the soft sell. And if you've got your phone open and your computer open and you're looking at your, you know, you're looking at your iPhone and you're answering a text message from, you know, from one of your other work colleagues, that person's going to take a message from that interaction that you're too busy to listen to their concern.
Right.
And they're going to sit on it. They're going to take it elsewhere or they're going to sit on it. And that's a missed opportunity for the company to get out in front of a potential issue. Because in this field, you know, it's all about trying to prevent the problem such that if it, something does go wrong, it doesn't hurt the company too profoundly.
Yeah.
So that training, that habit of actually listening to what the person is saying and not thinking about what you're going to say next or what you're going to have for lunch, that I think is the thing that improv brings to the table for many, many people in this space.
Yeah, I definitely active listening and being others focused. And I love how you weave that into leadership, because the other interesting thing about improvisation is it surrenders leadership and takes it back. It's a concept called follow the follower, where essentially when you join the ensemble, you are given leadership training, even if you aren't the director, right? I mean, and so mm-hmm. I think this idea of practicing what it's like to be in charge without ever having to be in charge is very much in an improviser's mindset. Mm-hmm. Jen?
Oh, yeah. It's very, I mean, it is very fluid. I think that it does promote active listening, but it also promotes a certain group culture and dynamic. Like what Erica was saying about somebody watching you answer a text while you are in a meeting with them, that messages to that person that behavior is in some way acceptable. And humor acts in pretty much exactly the same way.
Right.
As soon as you start telling jokes about certain things, it's a cultural signifier that tells people that this is okay for us to joke about, number one, and also the people that we're joking about as, you know, potentially the target or whatever that might be, are it is okay to target that group or that idea or whatever. So
yeah.
It's a way for us to sort of communicate those ideas. And improvisationally, that listening and that communication of behavior, which is in a lot of ways, I mean, that's what ethics is partly the study of, is like how we're how we behave, mm-hmm. how we should behave, how we should act, how we ought to act. And so in those situations, improvisationally, if the group culture is that of listening and allowing for failures and mistakes, that translates into other areas where you can use those skills. If you are somebody who is in a leadership position and you have fallen down on something, it puts you in a position and you work that muscle of being able to accept the responsibility for that and move through it with the help of other people.
Right. And zagging around a bit, because I want to do this, I also found an interesting take from Jonathan Freeman, who talks about improvisation as it relates to legal ethics. And he was writing in the John Marshall Law Review, and he wrote, "The lecture method ignores the individuality of the listener. An improvisational model succeeds most directly in permitting students to learn how to handle themselves in conflicts by enhancing their self-regulatory competence and confidence." And this part is really interesting. He says, "Competence and confidence is in the practice of a skill can only be achieved by doing. Sustained improvisation provides a clear advantage." And I thought that was really interesting, of this idea that you really need, and Erica, you were on this before, about that sort of confidence to speak, and then competence to understand what's going on.
Absolutely. And I actually, I wanted to circle back also on the point that Jen made about failure, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because I do think, you know, one of the other things that improv teaches you is that it is okay to screw up.
Yeah.
And maybe the thing that you screwed up is going to turn into something truly fabulous, and maybe it won't. And both of those things are going to be just fine. Because that is one of the things that we are seeing more and more, is the more your organization has a failure response of assigning responsibility, which sounds conceptually like a good failure response,
mm-hmm.
but what it really means is looking for someone to blame.
Right.
And you know, that's the tipping point, where if you're looking for someone to blame, oh, you know, D. Kelly, you know, that scene was going great until you stepped in and said, you know, Bob Dole or whatever the case may be. You know, that's, if it's that response, you're going to be a lot more guarded the next time around, and that will then sort of snowball itself over and over again. Mm-hmm. So this idea of confidence and practice and the bravery to make a mistake and the organizational response being such that that is okay, those are the factors that really, at the end of the day, contribute to a culture where someone is willing to raise their hand and say, hey, you know what, I've got a quality concern, I've got a safety concern, I've got a compliance concern.
Yeah.
Something that this actually happened while I was teaching the video game ethics class. When I first started, I would have my eyes and my nose on my lecture notes, and all I did was lecture directly to the students, and they were bored out of their mind, and I was bored out of my mind. But what wound up happening is, as an experiment, I had some bullet points and I had some lecture notes, but I engaged in more conversation and storytelling with them, and then, you know, would put them into groups, and then they would have to come up with things, and it became much more of a dialogue versus me just standing and talking at them. And what I noticed was, the more I offered those opportunities to them and I had the confidence, because initially when I was just reading off my lecture notes and they would challenge me about an idea, I was like, I don't know, please don't, everybody be quiet.
right.
But I, as soon as I put that aside and engaged with them, the grades skyrocketed,
right,
from what they were, because they were learning in the moment rather than me telling them something by rote that they could barely memorize anyway. So that was an instance where having this continued practice of engaging them in conversation, allowing them to have those moments of time learning, I think really it paid off. Because I sort of threw that stuff away and changed the model of the class.
Right. So, Erica, what I think you're probably both saying is this stuff is too important for check the box learning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, what we've seen, and we see this in the metrics associated with training effectiveness, check the box learning is the kind of thing that you can do if you really don't feel like, basically, if you're resorting to check the box learning, what you're saying to your employees is, this is not a topic that we feel is important enough to really engage you on. And that sends a message, right? That sends a message about the organization's priorities. If you look at it instead from a learning and development perspective, from an adult learning perspective, and you say, I'm going to make this engaging, I'm going to make this story-based, I'm going to make the kind of thing that I am really attempting to make sure that you retain this information, because I wouldn't be making you take this training if it wasn't important. That's the point at which you start to see some of those outcomes turn around and you get the results you want.
Yeah. I was talking to Raj Sisodia, who co-founded the Conscious Capitalism Movement, and they talk about how doing the right thing can be at odds with profit and growth. Mm-hmm. And then I was trying to find a quote in this field, and I found this really nice Bill Moyers quote, which goes back to our people discussion. And he wrote, "Our very lives depend on the ethics of strangers, and most of us are always strangers to other people." And so, like, in addition to acknowledging that bad acts are going to happen, which is something we talk about, we also have to acknowledge that people are very different from one another, mm-hmm. right? And so perspective, I think, becomes very important when we talk about wanting to be ethic. And I think we have a simplistic idea of our ability to understand right from wrong because we're really just seeing it from our own POV, not another one.
I think that that's very true. I think it's often hard to put yourself fully in the shoes of another person. But anytime, and this actually happens with video games and when we have the discussion about what it means to do perspective taking, mm-hmm. Where when you are playing a video game, particularly like sandbox first-person shooters maybe, or video games that just put you right into the action, like something like Fable or Skyrim, those games... They give us the ability to be somebody else and respond to the world as somebody else. And empathy can go up if we are afforded those opportunities with video games. However, if those video games also deal in stereotypes, then empathy for that particular class of person
goes the other way.
It goes the other way.
So I'm curious, has there been, Erica, any virtual reality advances in the learning model around ethics and compliance?
It's interesting that you ask that, because it is something that I know a lot of companies are looking at right now. There's been evolution over the course of the last 10 years. Courses are getting shorter. There's more and more of a mix between the online and the live environment. Things are getting more engaging. The Second City shorts are a great example of that, you know, where you take a real-life scenario, you make it a tiny bit ridiculous to get the humor in there, but you're really driving home a very vivid and engaging point with it. Virtual reality, I think, is a place that we're headed. You know, we are certainly seeing some game-based activities. I would call it more gamification than gaming. So sort of taking some of the gaming elements and putting it into training. A little bit of that competitive piece of it to try to engage the employees with the scenarios themselves. But we've got a long way to go. I mean, you know, let's call a spade here. We're certainly not in the first-person virtual reality kind of situation, but I think we're going to have to get there because, you know, at the end of the day, as human beings, we learn through stories, right? That's how we end up engaging with each other. That's how we've always engaged with each other. And if I can take an abstract concept like conflicts of interest and I can put it in very real terms for my organization and I can run you through it in such a way that you really feel the scenario, I will have gone a very long way towards helping you gain the tools you need to make the right decision when your brother-in-law comes to you and says, hey, you've got to hire my company for this next thing that you guys are doing.
Yeah, no, yeah, and I think you're right about VR. I mean, it is fascinating. I think it will be potentially a bit of a game changer. Mm-hmm. I experienced it at a storytelling festival, and this was actually a person who wanted to introduce VR into news experiences because she felt that we were getting numb by all this news. And so literally we could go into, put on the goggles, and we were in a cell at Guantanamo next to a prisoner. And it was very powerful. And it was an empathy booster shot when I experienced it. So that was very cool. And I think, you know, in general, the sort of gamification or game idea, I think it's kind of interesting how we started this conversation, referencing how we're using media to more effectively train people in the areas of ethics and compliance. But it's the proliferation of new media that is likely muddying the waters around ethical behaviors. And I'm thinking about like Gamergate and social media in general.
Yeah, it's one of those. I mean, this is sort of an easy answer to that. But like, I think that there are when you can go online and just spew whatever it is that you want to spew. I mean, I'm a big fan of the internet. I think that it is a wonderful place, but then there are also places that are less wonderful. And I think that with the, and this is actually proven, that when you engage in online without any other information, say, like if you and I are having a Skype conversation, I can read so many visual cues from you. I don't have to fill in any holes in terms of what I'm getting from what you're saying to me or trying to communicate to me. But when we're online, it's sort of like you're in a car. Mm-hmm. Like there's so much coming at you all the time. You have things that challenge your own identity constantly. And so when we don't have the capacity to engage with people one-on-one or even in another like sort of visual Skype sense, we fill in very negative holes around what people say to us. And so the result then is escalation rates that are very high. You go from just a polite disagreement to you're what's wrong with everything in the world.
Right.
And so I think that when we're talking about and also because of that, so much of it is consequence-free. So we don't get a sense of, well, I've put this out into the world and how it actually might be affecting other people. So when we talk about ethics, we're also talking like we're talking about how we ought to live, and how we ought to live oftentimes extends to social groups. And if we don't get any sense of what we're getting back from our behaviors, then all it does is solidify that what we did was right, because
right.
we like to be
right. Right, 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 of course. Erica, how does the sort of social media, advent of social media, how has that affected you and what you do?
You know, it's been a really interesting process to watch companies try to figure out how they can effectively use social media, especially as the demographics of the workforce are changing. So, you know, we're seeing a lot more compliance officers blogging and writing, chat tweeting or tweet chatting, and, you know, other sort of ways of communicating around some of these key issues. We're seeing the rise of ethics and compliance related apps that companies are using to try and reach their employees with just-in-time information. You know, oh, hey, the travel and entertainment system just showed me that you booked a flight to India. Let me, you know, Bing you on my company phone that we gave you with a reminder around our gift entertainment policy and the limits of what you're allowed to buy in terms of meals for a government official while you're in India. Hmm. That kind of sort of, you know, right at the information right at the moment that you need the information, I think has been and the most exciting area that we've seen from a social media perspective for a lot of folks in my space. It also comes with a ton of attendant risks, right? You know, what can you say on social media? What can't you say on social media? Should your managers be Facebook friends with the people that report to them? You know, all, there's a whole host of new risk areas mm-hmm. that come along with the advent of some of these different tools. So, you know, it's like anything else new. People are figuring out how to use it appropriately and what the social mores are, and then also, you know, how to really effectively leverage it as a tool.
Yeah, it's funny. My son just graduated high school, and this summer he has now become Facebook friends with a bunch of his teachers. And I was like, oh, yeah, you weren't allowed to, they wouldn't allow that before.
Yeah.
And, it, you know, it's kind of fun seeing how that dynamic changed. When I was Googling, I found this really interesting article from New York Magazine in May, and the title is Unethical Amnesia Explains Why People Conveniently Forget Their Awful Behavior. And I first of all, Unethical Amnesia, I think, would be the name of a great punk band. Basically, it says that recalling unsavory actions causes psychological discomfort, so people have fuzzier memories of the bad things they've done. I mean, that makes perfect sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a thing?
Yep.
Yeah, it is, right? Oh, wow. It's I didn't know that was a thing before I looked it up, but that is fascinating to me.
Well, that goes into taking on somebody else's POV. It's like, it's really hard for us to to fail, accept criticism, and we have biases. Sure. We have a bias that tells us that we're right. We overestimate how right we are. And so when something happens that we've behaved poorly or done something wrong, we tend to forget it more readily.
Yeah. This also feels like just basic self-regulation, right? The stuff that we're supposed to be learning when we're little kids, and maybe we forget that we need to keep learning it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think so, absolutely.
Again, at the end of the day, it's all about the people,
right.
You know, and figuring out how to reach people that are out there creating risk for you on a daily basis, whether it's through, you know, things like improv skills and active listening for your managers, or looking at, you know, tools and controls. There's a ton to learn from behavioral psychology, you know, things like the research that's done around why people lie and what could potentially stop them from doing so. One of the most fascinating examples that I'll throw out there for you guys is if you move the certification that you complied with the travel and expense and gifts policy from the last thing you do on your T&E form to the first thing you do on your T&E form. So before you enter anything into the form, the first thing you have to do is check the box that says, yes, everything I'm going to put on this form is going to be in line with our policy. You see T&E fraud decrease dramatically. And it's because you've immediately reminded somebody before they've done the stupid thing of what it is that you expect of them. And so those kinds of insights are the things that I'm most excited about for the future of this space.
Well, Richard Thaler would be very happy to hear all that, because you just did a nudge, right? That's a choice architecture stuff, which is something we're So I don't know if we talked about this, Erica, when we talked before, but we're actually working with Richard Thaler's group at the University of Chicago around the ideas of how choice architecture and its theories can be matched with improvisation, because improvisation is all about making new and different and better choices.
Yeah. And getting yourself in the habit of doing that.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Creating that habit. It's really fertile ground, and you guys we're at like 30 minutes. I could talk for this for another 30, but I want to ask you both one question. Jen, I'm going to start with you because you're an improviser and you're used to this kind of stuff. The title of this podcast is Getting to Yes and the idea around that is so many people in business say no because no is the safer choice. But when you say yes and to something, you are putting yourself out there, you're exploring and heightening. Can you think about something in your life and your work that was a yes and moment where you could have said no to something, but instead you said yes and? Jen?
I think it was when I directed my first, and this is when it became Urban Twist, but it was my first outreach and diversity show. Mm-hmm. I was anxious about, especially because of the climate, it was the first entirely black ensemble mm-hmm. with a black music director.
And you're a white female.
And I'm a white female, mm-hmm. by the way. And I am very, I'm very sort of strict with myself about like wanting to make sure that I'm honoring people's perspectives and not encroaching and sort of being the white person in the room who's going to explain racism to everybody, if that makes sense. And so I had hesitation about it, and I actually, in thinking about it and having conversations with my husband about it, it became clear to me that I needed to do this so that. It made me a better person. It's probably one of the most powerful directing experiences I've ever had, because it was less about me telling people what to do, and more about me hearing what was going on in these performers of color's lives and how they responded to it, and for them to for these actors to be in a space where they could totally fail if they needed to. And that lended to them succeeding in really fantastic ways. And it was, I'm forever grateful for that experience. And I think that I was afraid of being that person. And because of, instead of like going along with that fear and just sort of siloing myself off, I opted not to.
Right. And you were allowing yourself to be fueled by discomfort mm-hmm. rather than, you know, defeated by discomfort.
Absolutely.
Which is an improv thing.
I was enormously uncomfortable, like just having to confront some of my own ideas.
Yeah, your own cognitive biases. Yeah, we all have them.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so that was, but it was, I mean, it seems very big for me to say that it was one of the most rewarding and fantastic learning experiences ever. And as an achievement as a director, I loved that show.
Yeah.
Because I felt a part of it versus on top of it.
Yep, me too. Erica, do you have a yes and story?
Well, it might not be exactly what you have in mind, Kelly, but my yes and story is actually the time that I did yes and training with Second City.
Oh, so, I love that story. come on.
So I was actually part of a group that went up to do a combined effort project with some of the Second City folks and myself. So I was the content expert from a compliance perspective, and then the Second City guys were the improv guys, and it was for the 100 top managers for a client of mine. And we got up there and got in the room, and they were all, you know, the 100 top managers were very nervous about this whole improv thing and what the heck was going on, and the compliance officer was very nervous. Like,
right.
Doing this project with us was his yes and moment.
Yeah,
because
right.
He had no idea how this thing was going to go down.
Mm-hmm.
And I originally was, I was the content expert, right? Like, I'm not doing the improv part. And then the director of that program looked at me and said, if you don't do this, they're not going to do this. So let's go.
Oh,
and so
no.
I actually got on. Yeah. So I got on stage with the whole troupe.
Uh-huh.
And we did yes and.
Yeah.
And we did last word. And we did, you know, we did all the exercises You know, we did thank you, yep. You know, active listening, gratitude, attitude of gratitude stuff. And it was, I mean, I had always sort of thought myself to be a good listener and communicator before that, but it was a really profoundly, it made a really profound impression on me to just go through those exercises and to, and again, you know, to do something on stage that I was not particularly comfortable with. So I've used the skills ever since. So that's my yes and moment.
I love it because, you know what it is? It's terrifying and transformative. Yeah, and that's and that is it, and I won't kid anyone. I mean, like, honestly, I've been around this work for 30 years. When I get called on to improvise, it immediately just I go in my head, I get uncomfortable in my body, and then after I do it, I feel great, like like the best workout.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it was funny that my friend at the University of Chicago that we're working with talks about this in a diversity and inclusion sense because she feels like we're getting that conversation wrong. And she uses this gym metaphor, which is if you don't feel the burn, you're not doing it right. And this idea of we need to be able to talk from the discomfort. And maybe that's where improvisation meets some of those efforts. Mm-hmm. You guys, this has been a wonderful conversation. Eric and Jen, thanks for joining me on Getting the Yes And.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can find out more about the work that Erica is doing at ethisphere.com. And Jen Ellison's work is all over the city of Chicago. And she has a web presence, too.
Yes. yes, I do have a web presence. It is...
plug it.
Okay. I do a... I have a Tumblr called Drunk J Crew that is on... it's on Twitter, Drunk J Crew, you guys. And... it's on Instagram, and also I have Drunk Democracy, which is an offshoot of Drunk J Crew.
All right. Thanks, you guys. See you next week.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine, going down, working in a coal mine, about to slip down, working in a coal mine, going down, working in a coal mine, about to slip down.
This is Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. You can find us at WGNplus.com. You can stream us on the WGN Plus app, or you can find us on iTunes. See you next week.